I'm going to call this meeting to order. The first bill we have for consideration is House File 1395. Representative Mullery, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Move the bill.
Thank you. We have the bill before us.
Close to your bill. Madam Chair, I think we'll send it to the floor. No, I'm sorry, to taxes.
And taxes.
They can either send it to the floor or put it in their omnibus or both.
All right.
Madam Chair, can we just start?
Yes.
In order to keep things going fast.
Members.
Madam Chair, we don't need to really have another full hearing on this. We had an hour and a half, as you recall. There's been almost no changes since that, except one that was suggested by the Bar Association, which was that when the city later decides to change the use, that there be notice to people within 400 feet of it. Representative Bisgins in the last committee had a motion to take out a portion on what was done when they classified it, which nobody, I think it won by almost unanimous. And that's about it. And Mr. Nord is here if there's questions, but after an hour and a half, I think we all know the basics of the bill.
Any questions from committee members? Is there anybody who wishes to testify in opposition to this bill? In that case, since we have had that much testimony, and seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 1395 be passed and referred to Command Taxes. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Okay. The next bill we have for consideration is House File 2881. Would someone like to move Representative Kath's bill to get it before the committee? Thank you. Representative Mahoney moves House File 2881 to pass to the General Register. So we have the bill before us. Representative Kath, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill before you is a DWI bill that looks at specific blood samples and who can take those blood samples. What it does is it makes sure that we are allowing all qualified people to take that blood so that way we can expedite the process for our police and our court systems. But I do have one oral amendment that I would like to make to the bill on page 2. And on page 2, line 2.8, we would like to strike at the end of line 2.8, or acting under, and then strike all of 2.9 up to the period. So it would strike or acting under the supervision and direction of a physician or registered nurse. It is not needed. It is just kind of extra language. And Alina, we had talked to some individuals from there, and they had said that what we have up to withdraw blood would actually suffice for all licensed personnel. And with that, I will stand for any questions, as well as
we have. I'll ask that somebody move that amendment.
I'll move it, Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom moves the oral amendment. Was everyone clear on what's being struck? Any questions on that? Then, seeing no further discussion on the amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. And now the bill is in the shape the author wishes it, and to your amended bill.
Yeah, as you'll see that there's very little language here. It just says that after on page 1.11 and 1.12, after we label some individuals who are able to take that blood, it also says other qualified persons, and then on the back just defines qualified person.
Yeah.
All right. Any questions at this point? Otherwise, I see you have someone who's here to testify.
This is Steve Simon with the DWI Task Force, and we would just stand for any questions that members have.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, just what's the impetus behind this? I mean, what's the problem we're trying to fix?
Representative Kraft.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Westrom. What we'll see here is right now in statute we label certain individuals who can withdraw blood, but as labels change in hospitals, specifically job descriptions and things of that nature, we want to make sure that anybody who is qualified to take blood is able to take blood for DWI samples. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Steve Simon with the University of Minnesota Law School, and he'll give you a little bit of background with it as well.
Madam Chair and Westrom. My name is Steve Simon. I am the director of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force. The task force has been in existence for close to 30 years. We're made up of police officers, prosecutors, people from the DPS, probation officers. The people from the criminal justice system bring us problems they have with implementing the law or gaps in it. We discuss it and analyze it, and then we come to develop recommendations for the legislature. This problem is that currently there are many people who can draw blood medically in hospital settings. They're trained, it's on-the-job training, but the DWI statute defines who can draw blood for an implied consent, a forensic sample, so to speak, and it has specific titles. So a police officer will arrest somebody for DWI, and the police officer chooses a blood test, takes them to a hospital, and the hospital, and a good example is the hospital in Anoka, they don't have somebody who fits one of these titles on duty who can draw the blood. They have people on duty who can draw blood and are drawing blood all the time, but they don't fit into one of the titles in the DWI statute. So by adding this or qualified person and defining qualified person, which says through training or experience and is employed to draw blood, they can draw this implied consent blood sample. Right now, when somebody's not there, either the law enforcement has to call and bring somebody in and wait, or if somebody draws blood at the hospital medically and then when it's challenged, the test is thrown out and the DWI case is dismissed. So this is purely a technical amendment, and it allows the system to work the way it should. It will result in significant saving to law enforcement and the courts, eliminating hearings that are based on technicalities.
Any other questions or any further discussion? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in favor of or against this bill? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 2881 as amended be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we'll have Representative Hornstein, House File 3134. Representative Mahoney?
Sure.
Representative Mahoney will move 3134 and to the General Register. Representative Hornstein, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3134 is equal access to personal asset distribution dealing with probate. And I got interested in this bill and I guess this set of bills that the committee has been hearing on this topic when I had a couple of constituents who were not directly affected by this particular issue, but they were affected by a similar issue with Representative Thiessen has been addressing. It was a couple in my district, Jim and Dwayne, and Dwayne had medical issues that he was dealing with and was hospitalized. And his partner could not see him in the same way, visitation rights in the same way that a heterosexual couple would have been able to. And that really got me thinking about the inequality that many of our neighbors and constituents face on a day-to-day basis. This is an attempt to deal with this in terms of issues in terms of the Uniform Probate Code. And so I'm going to see if this is, again, somewhat technical, and if either counsel or Ms. Kaner-Roth would want to go through section by section of the bill, Mr. Chair, if that would be helpful or useful to you, we could do that.
Can you hit the high points? I don't think we were...
Okay, then fine. I could have Ann Kaner-Roth, the Executive Director of Project 515, do that. We've been working together on this bill.
Ms. Kaner-Roth?
What?
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Ann Kaner-Roth. I'm the Executive Director of Project 515. And just by way of introduction, Project 515 is a nonprofit organization with a specific goal of ensuring that same-sex couples and their families have equal rights and considerations under Minnesota law. In 2007, the organization identified at least 515 Minnesota statutes.
Ms. Kaner-Roth, we are really under the gun this morning. Please just go to the bill.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, the Equal Access to Personal Asset Distribution Bill essentially puts into place a definition for domestic partners and also opens up the probate statutes to include that definition in the places where spouse is indicated. So essentially, the protections that would be allowed would allow the assets of a person who dies without a will in place to be distributed to their domestic partner.
Okay. Are there any questions on this bill? Is there anybody from the audience that wants to speak? Mr. Pritchard?
On any of these?
Again, very quickly, as we said, and to the point of the bill. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Pritchard.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council. I want to speak in opposition to this bill, and there are also three other bills, which I won't come up to testify again on, 3135 and 3086, which we would also oppose, because basically what they're attempting to do is redefine marriage by another name under the guise of domestic partnerships. We believe that these bills, and this bill also injects confusion and ambiguity in the law. They're creating a definition of domestic partner, which I think will open up disputes between other parties who may come in conflict, saying, well, are you really a domestic partner? If you look at the definition, it talks about a committed interdependent relationship, responsible for basic welfare, financial. What are those things, really? And so we're concerned that you're going to open the door up to confusion and probably more litigation. We're concerned about the discriminatory nature of this bill and these bills. They exclude other family members or other persons who maybe care for another person. So we ask, why are we just creating this narrow additional benefit to these individuals, and when in fact there are other people that care for one another, but they would be excluded? So this is discriminatory, and I think frankly this bill may be in conflict with the human rights discrimination provisions, because you're limiting it to same-sex persons, whereas people of the opposite sex also might care who are not married but also want to provide and care for one another. It's also unfair to married couples, because married couples have a legal status and legal obligations, whereas these individuals are getting the benefits without the responsibilities. And fundamentally, this is really an effort to redefine marriage, pure and simple. And that raises the question, why do we give marriage special status? Because we realize it's unique benefits that marriage provides to society, a mother and a father, the raising of children, providing a stable environment in a family and a home life. And also, finally, this bill opens the door to legal attacks on marriage. In other jurisdictions where they've established marital-like status under the guise of domestic partnership, it's opened the door to litigation and challenging existing marriage laws. So for those reasons, we oppose this bill and the other bills which established domestic partnerships. Thank you.
Thank you for being brief, Mr. Pritchard. Representative Westrum had it.
Mr. Chair, just quickly to the prior witness. You indicated under a will that they couldn't receive the same benefits. If you could explain that, because there's no reason that I'm aware of, or what is the reason your partner or your friend or whoever it is couldn't be named as the beneficiary under the will?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I may have misspoke, but what I intended to say was if someone dies without a will, if a married couple, well, if one of the spouses in a married couple dies without a will, the spouse is sort of the default recipient of the estate. For a domestic partnership, that's not the case. So if one person dies without a will in place, then the domestic partner does not have access.
Mr.
Chair, to the witness, I mean, that would be the same as if two, a male and a female live together, if you don't put your estate plan in place, the person you're living with wouldn't benefit necessarily if you didn't draft a simple will document. What would be the difference? And it seems to me, why would we make this big of a change when we've already got a legal tool that could be used?
Mr. Chair, the definition of domestic partners would not include a man and a woman who just happen to be living in the same home. It is more expansive than that. So that situation wouldn't necessarily apply here under this definition.
Okay. Is there any other Representative Horn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, over the years we've seen a lot of similar bills, and in some instances the same-sex requirement has not been included. I'm just wondering your rationale. Is it that you don't believe unmarried opposite-sex couples should have this ability as well? Or
Ms. Ann Ross? Or is this for Representative
Feinstein? Mr. Chair, we can both take a crack at it. I think that this is just narrowly defined because this, you know, the particular issue affects domestic partners, and we want to address that one, you know, very narrowly in this bill. It's not to take rights. It's not. I disagree with, you know, Mr. Pritchard. We're not taking rights away from anybody. We're not defining marriage. We're just simply saying there's a void with this particular group of people, and this bill narrowly addresses that. I don't know if Ms. Kainer-Ross would want to add anything.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holper, just to expand on that a little bit, we certainly would not oppose including opposite-sex couples in this language, but the mission of Project 515 really deals with same-sex couples, and so part of our goal is to highlight discrimination. But we would not oppose that kind of language.
Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass and send to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. I'll call again. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? No.
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 Carries. Next bill, Simon, 3135. Representative Simon, Representative Hillstrom moves your bill, and it goes to the General Register, my understanding. Go ahead, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This, like the previous bill, is one of the Project 515 bills, but this one deals with judicial equality and access. I will walk you through the basics of the bill. Basically, this bill... pardon me, members. Here we go. Presently in judicial proceedings, there is a difference between the rights that same-sex couples and heterosexual couples have, and this bill seeks to remedy that in a number of ways. Let me just give you a quick run-through of the bill. Section 1 allows a surviving domestic partner to present the notice for an action for a wrongful death claim involving a tort claim against a state employee. Section 2 allows a surviving domestic partner to present the notice for an action for a wrongful death claim involving a municipality or municipal employee. Section 3 provides that recovery in a wrongful death action against a person or corporation is for the exclusive benefit of the surviving domestic partner. That's no different than we have right now for a married couple. Section 4 allows a surviving domestic partner to petition a court in a wrongful death action to appoint a trustee who could begin the action and obtain recovery of damages. Again, something that we do for others in our judicial system. Section 5 prohibits a domestic partner from testifying in a court proceeding for or against the person's domestic partner without the consent of the domestic partner. Also prohibits testimony about any communication between the domestic partners. Section 6 just extends the crime victim services and rights to domestic partners. Section 7 requires employers to allow a crime victim's domestic partner reasonable time off from work to attend criminal proceedings related to the case. Section 8 provides for crime reparations award for loss for support of a domestic partner in case of a death. And members, I would just tell you one quick thing, and that is that the domestic partner definition in this bill it was taken, and for all these bills, you should know, was taken from some of the most esteemed Minnesota-based Fortune 500 companies. Everyone here who attended the chamber dinner, and I imagine that's almost everyone in this room, I would bet you that a majority of the tables were staffed by corporations that have this exact same wording or very close to it. So this is already in the corporate world. Already our most trusted corporate citizens are way ahead of us on this. And members, I know there are strong opinions and different opinions in this room on these issues, but that's the bill, and you'll vote your conscience. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak on this? We all know the basics of it. Okay, any discussion on the committee? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass 3135 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Representative Simon, 890.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair will move 890 and send it to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this was one of those bills, House File 890, that we already voted on, that this committee voted on, I should say, last year. And just
we
came
don't
back
need to
the
hear
General
any
Register.
Of the testimony again.
Right. No, we're not going to rehash it, but there is an amendment in your packet. There should be. And that's really the reason that I have a testifier, is just to speak to the necessity for the amendment. Is that in the packet?
A5?
Right now. Okay. And just to talk about the amendment, I'm not going to rehash the underlying bill since we passed it. I'm going to turn it over to the testifier.
Okay, first we have to put it on. Representative, the chair will move A5 to get it in the shape the author desires. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead very quickly.
And one more thing, Mr. Chair, I just need to say for the record, this bill with the amendment is supported by Resolve, by the Minnesota Bar Association, and by the Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. To the testifier.
Okay. Very quickly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment is being tendered based on the input of the Family Law Section and other sections of the Minnesota Bar Association to require a written agreement and to require it to be executed prior to the initiation of the pregnancy, both of which are logical amendments and should be supported by the committee.
Okay, thank you. Anyone in the audience that needs to testify? Oh, Mr. Pritchard? You promised to do it on the first one and not on the others.
Well, this is a different one.
Broken promises.
No, I said
Mr.
I would.
Pritchard, very quickly.
Partnerships.
Go ahead.
Tom Pritchard, President. We just want to state our opposition to this bill,
okay.
Too. This bill, this is a more radical version of a bill the governor vetoed a couple years ago on surrogacy, and I think we need to look at the radical nature of this bill. This is basically allowing couples through private agreements to basically buy and sell parental rights and ultimately children, and we think it's a very radical proposal. And to be able to sell and buy paternity, maternity children, basically, through private agreements. And this is really, I think, more extreme, at least to my knowledge, than any other state in the country. And there's nothing in here to protect the interests of the child. Basically, people can contract without even looking at what the children's interests are. If you look at, I think it's Section 4, it allows them to bypass home studies, personal studies, guardian ad litem, all those things. So the children's interests are not protected here. And so we just want to draw your attention to that and say we're very concerned that this will also undermine the adoption process. Basically, they're throwing out the whole understanding of adoption, of protecting the interests of the child, and allowing private individuals to contract for the buying and selling of babies conceived outside of sexual intercourse. And so we're just very concerned about that and oppose that. Thank you.
Mr. Pritchard. Okay. Representative Truskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pritchard, a question for you. Under this bill, the contract parents would they have the ability to order an abortion?
Mr. Pritchard, Mr. Chairman, I think you'd have to ask the author on that. I'm not really.
Or Representative,
I'm not sure how that'll play out, but that's another issue for sure.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to hand that one over to the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, the simple answer to that is no.
Okay. Then I'll renew my motion to pass House File 890 as amended and go to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Representative, is Thiessen here? Okay. Then Representative Norton, 2709. Somebody want to move that?
Go to the general register.
Representative Hilstrom moves 2709. Representative Norton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have the A1 amendment, which will I'd like to make some oral changes to so that it matches with the Senate bill and makes it non-controversial.
Oh, that's no fun.
The A1 amendment, Representative Norton. Representative Hilstrom moves the A1 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Norton.
I needed to amend the amendment, sir,
okay.
So if I could do that now.
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to remove lines 1.9 through 1.12 and remove section 1 from my amendment, which means the current law will stay in place. And then...
Representative Norton, wait.
Yep.
You said lines 1.9 through 1.12.
Of the amendment.
And then you said section 1...
And instead remove section 1 from the bill.
Yeah, Representative Norton, you gave the wrong lines. It's 1.3 to 1.12.
No.
No?
From the amendment,
okay,
not from the bill.
So it's we're removing 1.3 through 1.11.
On the bill.
No, on the amendment.
On the amendment, sir, we would be... I was going to change the amendment. Would you prefer to change the bill?
No,
since we,
sure.
What would be the parliamentary inquiry? What would be the motion to reconsider the amendment?
Thank you.
That would be a motion.
May I make that motion, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
You move quick in this committee.
You want to, we're trying to.
To the amendment.
Our staff says that it's 1.3 through 1.1. Oh, staff says he must be doing something other than his understanding.
I need to, on the amendment, I need to remove line 1.9 through 1.12.
Okay.
And then I believe what we can do is insert the words, remove section 1 from the bill. So we're just going to delete the entire section 1 of the bill.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, on your amendment, you actually amend section 1. So are you saying you also want the portion of the A1 amendment on lines 3 through 7? Or 8 to not be part of your bill when it leaves here?
When the bill leaves here, I would like on my bill 1.6 through 1.20 removed.
But Chair, Representative Norton, my question is to your amendment.
Okay.
Your amendment, Section 1, will amend your bill, Section 1. So what I'm trying to ascertain from you is, when you leave here, do you want on your amendment lines 3 through 8 to be part of the bill or to be gone? And because it depends when we take section 1 out of the bill whether or not you want that language to stand.
I see what you're getting at. Thank you.
Representative Norton, we've been discussing with staff. What you really should have done was a delete all with this as the new bill, and then remove lines 1.9 to 1.11 so that just 1.9, 1.10, and 1.11 are done, and staff can then treat this, my understanding, as a delete all, and we'll make the corrections first description, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, now we are ready to go. Representative Norton, to your new delete all amendment, which we will, now is the author's intent. Okay, all in favor? No, more changes?
Mr. Chair, there are two words that, Senator Betzel added on line point...
Should have known.
1.17, after the word "who," he adds the word "previously."
Which "who"?
The first "who." And on line 1.23, after the first "who," he adds the word "previously." And on line 1.26, after the period, he adds a "c."
Did you get them?
Okay, I've got one on line 1.17, after the first "who," the word "previously," is that correct?
That's true.
And then the next thing is on 1.26, after the period, a paren "c," end of parens?
And on, yes, that's correct. And on line 1.23, after the word "who," first "who," thank you, "previously."
Okay.
And then we're ready.
We're ready to call
And Mr.
Eureka.
Chair, I'm assuming that "c" on line 26 is in parentheses.
It is.
That's what I indicated, Representative Holbrook. Okay. All in favor of the amendment, the delete all as set forth what the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll make this quick, and I apologize for the changes. There was a little bit of controversy, which is why the bill hadn't been heard earlier in this committee. This fixes it. I believe you will have a non-controversial bill that will extend the Good Samaritan protection currently in law to businesses and nonprofit entities during a good faith, to be able to practice in good faith during an emergency. It would only be triggered by a governor's emergency declaration, and I think we will just let the testifier who's come up from Rochester to testify and then answer any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead. And
Mr.
Remember,
Chair, I'm Frederick Golting, and I represent the Minnesota Dental Association and also the American Medical Association National Disaster Life Support Educational Consortium. And the bill simply is, as Representative Norton said, extends liability protection to nonprofits, business who take part in disaster recovery. For example, when the bridge collapse happened, it happened right at the front door of the Red Cross. And the Red Cross people, of course, went out to help, but if they had been deployed as the Red Cross, it would have been possible they could have been sued afterward. We're trying to close the gap because right now entities are protected during mass vaccination clinics at the point of distribution, and we're just trying to make it so that they are covered during all declared disasters.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that has any, Mr. Moore? Quickly.
Mr. Chairman,
I know that's hard for you.
My name is Vic Moore with the firm Franzen & Moore, and I'm representing the American Red Cross. And for the record, the Red Cross strongly supports this legislation.
Thank you. Boy, that's brief for you. Okay. any discussion from anybody? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 2709 as amended by the delete all, which was amended. And that goes to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next bill
Thank
is,
you, members.
Is
roll over temporarily, Joe.
That's what I was told last night. They weren't ready.
is
Simon got another one? You mean this? Representative Simon, is yours? Oops. Representative Simon?
Yeah.
Is yours controversial? Okay, come on down. This is the one just changing the transit to the same as transportation on
yes.
the funding? Okay. Representative Simon, I'll move your bill to get things going here. And does it go to the General Register or to one of the...
Mr. Chair, my understanding is it goes to the General Register.
Okay. Representative, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was the subject of a procedural maneuver on the floor yesterday. It was accidentally routed to the wrong committee, and so thank you all for supporting the motion to get it back here where it belongs. This is a simple change to extend the current rule, which is recognition of federal law as to transportation, to transit as well when it comes to right of first refusal in the eminent domain context.
You don't
have the bill.
Where is it? White.
Oh. For some reason, it's not in the packets. I just found out.
If you'd like me to come back, I can do that.
Why don't we take all questions on it, if possible, and then if somebody has something... Okay. Still... Okay, Representative Simon, I guess we can't go ahead now.
Okay.
I don't know why it's not in the packet.
If you'd like to get over, or I can come back, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you just step aside, and maybe we can come back to you in a few minutes if we get it back. Representative Holberg, do you want to do one of yours?
Sure. Mr. Chair, which one would you like?
How about 3361? Representative Holberg moves House File 3361, and that goes to the floor, does it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
To General Register Director. Go ahead, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There should be a handout for you explaining what we're trying to accomplish here. The problem is that we have individuals that are trying to seek information from domestic abuse shelters on employees and volunteers. That information is putting them at risk, so this would provide protections for that information to avoid that situation. And I have a testifier here that can address the issue.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca McLean, and I'm the operations manager for the St. Paul Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3361. Our organization is a nonprofit, community-based battered women's program that serves over 4,800 victims of domestic abuse each year. We provide acute intervention services and often work with victims of highly lethal chronic offenders. In the spring of 2009, our agency became the focus of a data practices request. The request was for copies of our entire volunteer and employee rosters, and records, training manuals, protocols, daily procedures, and employee manuals. The initial request was made to the St. Paul City Attorney's Office to secure these documents from our program because we received some funding, city funding, to provide advocacy services on domestic abuse cases. The city did provide information from the grant, that being our quarterly reports that are produced under our contract. The matter then went to the Office of Administration for a written opinion. Under the written opinion, it was determined that the data practices request did apply to our nonprofit agency. The request for our employee and volunteer roster and records and all training manuals and procedures has now been made directly to our program. This request is not related to any particular case or domestic abuse incident. It is a general data practices request. We do not want to turn over this information, not because we're trying to hide anything. It's because releasing this information would greatly compromise our ability to provide critical services to victims of domestic abuse and jeopardize the safety of our staff and volunteers. The blanket data practices request is very dangerous to our organization and other agencies that serve victims of domestic abuse and sexual assault. 24 hours a day, our agencies take great measures to ensure the safety of women and children we serve, as well as our employees and volunteers. We maintain security systems at our facilities, have emergency response protocols for when violent offenders attempt to enter our programs or harass our staff. There are specific guidelines as to where and how we visit a victim in their own home, and staff and volunteers are never allowed to use their last names or reveal any personal information regarding their identity. Recognizing the inherent dangerousness of the work we do, the criminal justice system and medical providers we work with do not document or request any information that would personally identify our staff or volunteers. We go to these great lengths because the women we serve are in grave danger when they come to our programs and shelters seeking help. Because the staff and volunteers within our organizations who often accompany victims to court and other appointments have been harassed, threatened, and followed by dangerous offenders. Because abusers have attempted and sometimes succeeded into breaking into our buildings.
Ms. McLean, can we wait a second? Is there any opposition to this bill? I think we all understand it and probably are going to support it if we can
And, Mr. Chair, there was a two-page handout that was supposedly provided that has a whole list of organizations that...
Representative Holberg, I don't see any opposition. I don't see any questions. I don't see any... I think...
And just so members know, we're not going to shield information related to financing, accountability kind of measures, but we will shield information to protect individuals.
Okay. Representative Holberg renews her motion to pass House File 3361, and it goes to the General Register, is my understanding?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you very much.
Representative Simon, do you want to come back? We now have your bill.
Thank you.
Representative Simon,
go
ahead.
After a gay rights bill and a surrogacy bill, this is refreshingly non-controversial. This bill simply adds, oh, I gave my copy. Now I don't have it. I gave my copy to...
It just adds transit funding under the United States.
Right, it just adds transit funding. Thank you, sir.
To what we already do for transportation.
Exactly, that's it. It adds transit funding. It was an oversight, apparently, when they drafted the law, and it just adds transit funding and a recognition of federal law. That's the bill.
Okay. Is there any opposition to this bill? Okay. Looks like there's no questions. Then I guess this was me. The chair renews his motion to send 3336 to pass and to the General Registers. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is anyone here? Representative Holberg, do you want another one?
Sure.
How about 3383? Representative Holberg moves House File 3383.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And I think this is a real simple one, probably.
Yeah, this is an agency bill that was sent down, I believe, from your leadership corner late on Friday. So I'm going to let Ms. Engler handle the details
of it. Ms. Engler, go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Engler on assignment at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. This bill relates to orders for protection and domestic abuse no-contact orders. The Bureau, in conjunction and in partnership with the judicial branch, makes information about these orders available, but there's a limited amount of data, names, genders, dates of birth, that kind of thing. Law enforcement wants to be able to add information into this system in order to better help them enforce these court orders. The problem being that depending on the source of the data, we have multiple data classifications that potentially compete with each other. So for purposes of consistency, the proposal, which is in Section 2, is that all of the data about these domestic orders for protection and no contact orders be classified as private data on individuals, and that data about the offender can be shared with the victim for purposes of enforcement of the order. Section 1 is merely a cross-reference to point folks to this language, which is not in Chapter 13.
Okay, thank you. I doubt that there's any opposition to this, but is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak on this? Anybody from the committee? I don't think. Okay, Representative Holberg renews her motion to pass 3383 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, next I can one. Do 23 in about 3 minutes.
Okay. 2 minutes.
As long as I'm here.
Representative Holberg moves 3023.
And Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment. This amendment will put the bill in the shape that I'd like to discuss it and reflects an agreement by the representatives of the data mining organization and those that are representing the consumers. Senator Betzold has also signed off on this language. This is an issue that's been hanging around here for 3 or 4 years, trying to get resolution. And basically what we're trying to do is provide individuals a guarantee of accurate information being provided about them in these services.
Is there any amendment to the amendment?
No.
Okay, then Representative Holberg, after the Norton one that we're going to have. Wow. All in favor of putting it in the shape the author wants with the A1 amendment, vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
And I have Mr. LeBeau and Bob Secora in the audience to stand by for questions.
They
were willing to sing Kumbaya and get their picture taken this morning.
I don't if everybody's in agreement on this after hearing it for 4 years, I think we're happy.
More than that.
Okay, is nobody else that has to speak from the audience? Okay, nothing on the panel? Okay, then Representative Holberg renews her motion to pass 3023 as amended to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Who's ready? I can do mine, I suppose. No, Lori's not here, is she? Is she? Okay, I guess we'll do. His is being, the amendment isn't quite ready. There's peace in the valley with the new amendment. Gunther's not here?
No, I've got witnesses.
I guess I'll do mine then. Okay.
Okay.
You can give it. Then we'll do Senate File 863, I guess, now is back.
What other bills you got?
The other one's not ready.
Does that matter to me?
Representative Mallory, Chairman of the Committee, would you like to speak to Senate, would you like to move your files? Is it Senate File 863?
Yes, and I'd move that first. I move Senate File 863.
Okay. Do you have, am I looking at amendments? Oh, looks no, like a deleter.
We're going to substitute the language from House File 3317 and work off that.
So your motion is what, Mr. Chair?
Substitute the language from House File 3317.
Representative Mallory, are you moving the DE1 amendment?
Okay.
Which is this?
It's done.
All those in favor of moving the Representative Mallory moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, to get it in the order that he would like, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill's in the fashion that you like.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman and members, Lori Beyer-Krupinski, who's the expert for the state on data practices, will explain the bill.
And, you know, we trust the data practice person, but we could take a short version and open it up for questions.
Mr. Chair and members, what you have in front of you is portions.
I think he just kind of cut you short.
Well, I don't even know what the bill is. Oh, Mr. Chair, you think so?
The DE1 amendment, has it come yet?
No.
Yeah. All right, we'll wait.
Just kidding.
No, why don't you explain it real quick.
Madam Chair and members, what you have in front of you is the pieces that were before you last time in House File 1083, the Omnibus Data Practices Bill. These are the portions that did not pass in some other vehicle last year. It does not include certain aspects of personnel data, which were more controversial last year. It doesn't include the outside added remuneration or the employees' email addresses, but includes changes to personnel data in general, some general clarification and technical changes, as well as changes to the process of temporary classification of data. So these are things that you've already seen before and passed out onto the House floor last year.
How should I say this? Is there reasonable peace in the valley on this?
Mr. Chair and members, these are the pieces that we have not heard any controversy on whatsoever.
Thank you. Representative Holman, did you have a question?
The concerns that I have with this are very minor in nature. I would recommend that it get approved and moved on, and as is with data practices, you can kind of massage things as you work through the process.
Members, I have in front of me a A2 amendment. So if staff can direct me, is this someone's amendment that wanted?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to do that. Representative Holberg, I believe, is okay with this, and I've agreed to take it and put it on the condition that it can be removed later if there's problems from like the Bar Association hasn't had chance to look at it. It's regarding release of appraisal data. So I would move to put that on here.
The A2 amendment?
Yes.
Have you now removed the A2 amendment? Is there any discussion?
Well, and Mr. Chair, just so people know that right now under current law, the public authority or political subdivisions can't disclose their stuff prior to a deal. So in other words, if they wanted to share by a vote of the majority of the body, they could share that information with the interested parties before an actual deal was cut. So in some instances, it makes sense to share that appraisal with the property owner prior to having a deal being made.
Is there any other discussion to the amendment? Representative Paymont.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory, I assume you took out my provision from last year.
I didn't take out your provision from last year. It's not included.
It's always nice to see diplomacy happen in a committee. Is there any other discussion? Did you have any further comments, Representative Greenhour?
I think we need to vote on the A2 amendment.
All right. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Mr. Representative Mallory, the bill is in the shape that you would like. Would you care for a vote right now?
Yes.
Any other discussion? Any other discussion? Any other testimony from the audience? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Senate File 863 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Same sign.
Did he ask?
You are on your way.
Went to the general.
To the general, to the members, if I could, Representative Mallory, I'm going to make sure that we're clear here. All those in favor of the Senate File 863 as amended, be recommended to pass to the general registry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the general registry. Thank you. You can't do that.
Abler, sir.
This one looks exciting. Well, Mr. I might need some help setting up a one-minute video here. My 11-year-old couldn't come and help me. So I'll see if I'm any good at this.
Well, okay, we'll get to the chair so I can.
Somebody move.
I'll move House File Number 3052.
Representative Abler, go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, I have an amendment to it's kind of technical.
I'll move the amendment to when it gets passed.
Move the amendment. Representative Abler,
you can help me.
Representative Abler is the. Is it an oral amendment?
No, it's written. And it just changes one word throughout the bill. I actually didn't keep it.
Okay, while it's being handed out, we go ahead and start explaining the bill.
Yeah, and actually when I can get this video going here, it's going to set the whole thing up really good here. So anyway, there's
Representative Faber, can you explain the bill? I don't know that we're going to do the video because we have a lot of bills left.
Okay, it's a 1 minute, but it's quite dramatic.
I saw it in
you don't
committee.
Have to.
I think everybody understands.
Cool. I've almost got it. And I respect your hearing.
My classmate has always been a folky kind of guy.
Anyway, there's a phenomenon going around where companies are doing pre-settlement funding, and what they'll do is they...
Representative Abler, could you explain it? We really
here it comes. The sound is cool.
Representative Abler, could you explain the bill, or else we're going to take Representative Gunther.
Okay. Is it up there?
No.
There now. I hear it.
Is it up or not?
No.
Anyway, Anyway, so the situation is that there's some companies will lend money to an injured
right there.
Is
that
working?
Thousands on your case. We can also help get you a qualified doctor or attorney. So call us first and get it all.
It's almost done.
After your car accident, you need to call Crash Cash. Our advances pay now, not next month or year. And if you don't settle, you owe us nothing. We can even get you a qualified doctor or attorney at no charge. Call us today for money tomorrow.
So that's all, Mr. Chair. Anyway, to me, that helps understand why the bill is here. When I saw that, I was appalled. And we don't want that in Minnesota. It's going on in various states across the country. And there's companies that actually do this. And so I had a bill and to limit their rate to usury numbers, and they didn't. That was would put them out of business. And so what we've got is a bill that has much consumer protection. It creates a standard, and the people who do this in Minnesota actually there's some normal ones, and that are honorable. And so this creates a whole section of law that makes them disclose, puts it in two languages if they have a second language. I've worked with the Insurance Federation. This language here just deletes the talk about litigation and calls it pre-settlement money because there was some concern this money could be used to go to litigation. This money is just for the living needs. The average award is about $6,000. That's actually kind of a loan, and they charge considerable interest. And as in the payday loans, I was troubled by what interest they charge. Unfortunately, some people need that kind of money. And so that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anybody from the audience opposing it?
Well, yeah. Did you move the amendment, Mr. Chair? Or was that adopted?
I moved. Representative Olin moved the amendment, and we just didn't vote on it. So all in favor of getting the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Now Representative Olin renews his motion to pass 2855 as amended. All in favor, say aye.
No. 3052.
I'm looking at Representative Gunter's. Sorry.
That was a good bill.
Representative Olin renews his motion to move 3052 as amended to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you,
Representative Gunther thought he was going to get away easy.
This is a good bill.
Representative Mahoney moves House File 2855. Representative Gunther, you're on. And boy, are you lucky. We're in a rush this morning, so I can't put you through all the things you used to put me through in your committee.
Mr. Chairman, not only did I treat you very well, but I watched you suffer most of the time.
Representative Gunther, you're getting senile. Representative Mahoney has moved your bill. Go ahead, Representative Gunther. A very short.
Very short?
Yes. There's not much of it that belongs in this committee.
No, it's 1624. Isn't that where it was? Wait a second. 1618. We're moving gross misdemeanor, and on
no.
Six. We're
Representative Gunther. This is the civil law committee, not gross misdemeanors. That's the wrong committee. Go ahead.
You're the one that wanted us here. What did you want us here for?
Why is this? I guess it was sent here without asking.
Is there just wanted to get me, didn't you?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Mr. Chair,
there must be.
The title on the bill does say that it modifies civil and criminal penalties, so I would assume
right.
There's some civil penalties that are modified.
Civil penalties. I would hope that the author of the bill, I mean his witness, would know what's in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, this is a department bill. And
Representative Gunther, there is civil penalties on bottom of page 15 and the top of page 16. So could you quickly...
Mr. Chairman, we didn't change the penalty. We just changed the period.
Okay, so the period of the, is affected by it.
That's correct.
I don't see any other civil penalties. Well, that's pretty simple then, Representative Gunther. That's all that really pertains to our committees. Is anybody in the audience opposed to that change of the period? Okay, any questions on the panel? Representative Champion?
Mr. Chair, there's also on line 16.31, any person who violates the prescribed area is guilty of a gross misdemeanor. Just to call your attention to it.
Representative Champion, that's a criminal penalty, so that isn't for this committee. That's a different committee. So, pardon?
Is this coming to me?
I don't know. It's up to you. It does have penalties. It has a gross misdemeanor. So I would think so.
If that's a new penalty, then it has to
go. I think it has to go to you. Representative Gunther?
We eliminated gross misdemeanor in two places in this section, and we brought them both back in this one, in the new language. So we didn't change anything. We just
moved it. Mr. Chair, if it's exactly the same penalty, then it doesn't have to come to me.
Right.
If they're just moving it. If they change the penalty, then they have to. But it could be heard tomorrow anyway. So
Representative Gunther, there's no change in the penalty then?
No.
Okay, then I guess it doesn't have to go.
Okay.
Okay. Then no further questions on the one middle section on extending the time? Okay. Then Representative Mahoney? Shortening the time. Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass House File 2855 to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
One dinner.
Who's up now?
I am.
Oh, are you ready? Okay, Representative Olin. Representative Olin moves House File 3391, and I assume you have an amendment for the Peace in the Valley?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have a DE1 amendment, and I will move a DE1 amendment, but I will like to orally amend that, too. So I'll tell you, the DE1 amendment's in the packet. The oral amendment basically removes Sections 4 and Section 5 of the DE1. Amendment.
So Representative Olin moves the DE1 amendment as printed with sections 4 and 5 removed. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Olin, go ahead and explain your
bill. I'll call on John Kingery from the County Attorneys Association to explain the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Kingery?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And the bill before you represents the work done by our Juvenile Law Committee and endorsed by our board over about the last year to 15 months. And we've worked with legal assistance on these provisions, and wanted to come forward with a bill that both sides agree with, and the amendment does reflect that. Basically, what Section 1 does is it indicates where there is a prior TTR and there are additional kids later in the family that before this, the option was to immediately go to a TPR. This will allow the county to go to a CHIPS proceeding, which will allow the children and remaining family members to receive services. Section 2 just clarifies who has a right to participate in the proceedings. And Section 3 is a change, actually going back to current law from prior to last session, in which when there is a runaway, the local law enforcement can return that child to a shelter facility if possible. What we've heard from various reports around the state is when you have a runaway, especially at night, the child, with the changes that were made last year, ends up going back to the parents' home, child runs away. It's picked up again, taken back home, the child runs away and is taken back home. This will allow law enforcement to take that child to a shelter facility.
Okay. Ms. Hogdahl, did you want to just say that it's everything's in agreement? Or
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, my name is Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project, and as Mr. Kingery's indicated, we've spent a significant amount of time in discussions back and forth, and the delete all amendment as amended does reflect the agreements that we have reached. So thank you very much to everyone in the committee and to the County Attorney's Association.
Okay, thank you. And anybody from the audience want to speak on this? Okay, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly about if a child's taken to a shelter care facility, can they be held against their will there, and or are parents notified? I'm just kind of wondering once they go there, what happens and what their rights are and what the rights of the parents are.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Holbert, I've got to apologize. I'm not familiar with that process, other than it is the process that's been in place for as long as this section has been there. And the clarification is what constitutes a safe place, and it clarifies that it can include a shelter facility. I can make some guesses, but I would prefer not to do that.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, maybe you can just get back to me. I just want to make sure that if we're bringing them to a private facility or a government-run facility, the number one, somebody's keeping track of that and that there's ability for parents to find out, et cetera. But I don't have any problem with the concept. I just want to make sure that the kids' rights are protected.
Representative Holbert, I'm quite sure they are from my old understanding what we were doing in the past, but I can't verbatim say it. But we will get back to you to guarantee it.
Okay, seeing no further discussion.
I'll move that
Representative Olin renews his motion to pass House File 3391 as amended to the General Register.
To the General Register. There's no other committee that we
all
need to
all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. I'll do 2707 then. House File 2707, and then I'll move the DE1 amendment to get in the shape.
All right. I've got the DE1. There we go. Okay, I have the first, Representative Mallory, want to move your bill?
Right.
You did? Great. All right. And then I have the DE1 amendment. Would you like to explain your amendment, Representative Mallory?
Would adopt it first, so then. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions regarding the DE1 amendment? Hearing
just
none.
Put in the shape the author wants.
That's right. In order to get this bill into the shape that the author desires, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this is a work that we, there was a lot of negotiation, basically, to get the language. What it does is there was a court decision that limited and said the court couldn't extend beyond 180 days in the statute, which they were doing, the stay of adjudication. And the reason for that is that often we have youth under treatment programs, and also we want to sometimes put them under kind of a club over the head to keep them going straight. And so we've agreed to a stay of the adjudication, but only after the 180 days already in the statute that the judge can do. This can only be done with the prosecutor's agreement. And the one other thing that we're doing is adding that when it's interest of the best interest of the child and public safety, so that I thought and the prosecutors agreed that adding public safety should have been probably in the place in the sentence in the very first place when they did it, because that should always be a consideration on a stay adjudication. And what this does is it's just adds that there can be a state of adjudication by the court with the consent of the prosecutor, and without the prosecutor's consent, the court cannot do it. It then it There are certain provisions allowing them to, for instance, take DNA, prevent them from carrying guns, things like that, that this was worked on for a long time by the juvenile section of the county attorneys, and they're now in agreement with this. And if you want further explanation, Mr. Kingery is here. But it's a pretty simple bill on that, and I think everybody's in agreement. The public defenders think it's in the best interest of the children. Youth advocates think it's in the best interest of the children. The prosecutors are satisfied. I believe that they have sufficient protection now because it can't be done without their agreement. So,
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mallory, I wouldn't say that everybody's in agreement with it. What about the crime victim in this situation? You know, we continue to withhold personal responsibility from kids. How long are we going to do that? You know, is there a point at which they finally are accountable as an adult?
Madam Chair and Representative Jaskowski, I think that we are holding them accountable. First of all, this can only be done, the judge can't do it. It requires the prosecutor to agree to it, and they do protect the people. And second of all, I happen to think that it's harder on most kids to be kept under a kind of a club for, so that they go through treatment. It's a lot of kids, you know, they would prefer to just take the sentence and then they're free and clear. This keeps them under a control, and they have to go and continue through treatment, or if they get in trouble again, then we've got the club over their head. So it keeps them, I think, and believe me, in the inner cities, you know, we have quite a few problems, and I think this will be much better in the long run. I think we are holding kids responsible this way. We're also helping them get out of the crime lifestyle and things like that, which is what I'm very concerned about.
Any further discussion? Any other questions? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one and seeing no further discussion, Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 2707 as amended be passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I will move House File 2988, Representative Pulowski's, the effects of that. Do you recommend to pass and sent to the General Register? Is that right? And sent to the General Register.
All right. We have a motion by Representative Hillstrom to pass House File 2988 and send to the General Register. Representative Pulowski, to your
Madam
bill.
Madam Chair, this is a bill that actually I'm carrying for the department, so I'm going to let the department address the bill.
Thank you. Please identify yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Michael Meilenberg. I'm here representing the Office of Enterprise Technology. This year we have a bill designed to make a small clarification within Chapter 13 that permits state agencies to use temporary computer cookies in order to facilitate electronic government services. There's currently a statute that limits the use of cookies generally. The statute does not make a distinction between permanent cookies and temporary cookies. A number of years ago when the internet was starting to be used, there was an outcry regarding cookies generally. People realized that temporary computer cookies were not a threat to privacy. The federal government has made changes that permit their agencies to use temporary computer cookies, and most of the states have as well. Computer cookies are designed to facilitate a transaction. For example, if you were to go to Amazon.com to buy a book, and you purchased the book and then started to go through the transaction in order to actually purchase it, you would notice that on page one you would fill in your name, and then on maybe page two you'd fill in your address, and then on page three you'd fill in your credit card information. State government has similar sorts of pages when it goes through transactions with citizens. For say, example, if you're applying for a grant or if you're applying for a license, we need a cookie. Just like Amazon.com, there needs to be a cookie to connect those pages together so that the information on page 2, which is your address, can be connected to the information on page 3, which is your credit card. Without a cookie, the system cannot trace those pages together. So we've heard from a number of agencies asking questions about this statute, and on behalf of the enterprise, on behalf of all state agencies, have submitted this legislation, which is designed merely to help us provide electronic government services to citizens. The statute is designed only to curb temporary cookies, because we know that many people have concerns about permanent cookies, and it would keep that restriction in place. We're not aware of anyone who opposes this legislation.
Any discussion to the bill?
Just real quickly, Madam Chair, will you be notifying the user that a temporary cookie will be used?
No, the statute is designed to exempt out temporary cookies from the notification. The notification requirement is actually the problem, because the way that the statute is written, it says that you have to provide notification, and if the person refuses to accept the cookie, that you still have to facilitate the transaction. But the problem is that the system cannot do that. It can't provide the transaction when the person refuses to accept the cookie. So rather than getting rid of that language, we decided to, it would be a more narrow exemption if we just wrote in there that temporary cookies weren't subject to the restrictions.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that line, will the details about differentiating between temporary and permanent cookies be outlined in the privacy policy on the website?
Yes. To the extent that anyone would be using a permanent cookie, they would still have to provide the notification on the website. So some websites use cookies, so they have to provide the notification up front. The problem comes in when there's an actual system that requires an interaction with state government. Somebody actually had to submit information to the state in order to facilitate a licensing application or something like that. Those cannot be done without some sort of cookie, and we need to make some sort of modification in the statute, because the statute says that we have to continue to provide the transaction even if the person refuses to use a cookie. You can say in your web browser, "I refuse to allow you to put a cookie on my computer."
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to be clear, the privacy policies are on the websites generally, and they're there so that users can peruse those and understand what the organization's policies are regarding cookies, etc. Will the government be outlining those clearly on the government website so that if the users want to take a look at that and see what their policies are, they will be disclosed there?
Madam Chair, members, yes. The policies are on there currently. On OET operates the North Star portal. We have a clear policy written right on the North Star, indicating what our policy is and how we use cookies.
Any further discussion?
I would just renew my motion that House File 2988 be recommended and passed and be sent to the General Register.
All right. First, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2988 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 2899 be recommended to pass and be sent to, where does it need to go?
The General Register.
The General Register.
All right. We have Representative Hillstrom's motion before us. Representative Pawlowski.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me yet, but I'm familiar enough with it, thank you, to tell you this bill has been the work of about the last 6 months, primarily with the Minnesota Newspaper Association. It's a bill that is to access information in a new way, particularly from public entities. We have had problems in the past going to local units of government, for instance, and if we use a newspaper as an example and being told that you would not get that information or you'd get it when they decided to give it to you, and your only access or recourse was district court. This opens up the Office of Administrating Hearings, and this would be a second way to get information. You could still go to district court, but this would be the primary way we think people would go. We know of no opposition to the bill, but there is an amendment, an A6 amendment, that has been worked out primarily with, I believe it's Education Minnesota, and if you could offer the amendment and we could put the amendment on. They had some concerns, and if there's someone from Education Minnesota here today, they may want to discuss the amendment.
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Hillstrom moves the A6 amendment, and I think we've already had our explanation. Any questions regarding the amendment, members? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of Representative Hillstrom's amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. All right, motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hulbert.
Yeah, on this amendment, I mean, this is moving pretty quick here, but on lines 5 and 6, why would you delay by 30 days an order, an enforcement order? What's the purpose of that?
Madam Chair, I was just given the amendment, and I was hoping Education Minnesota would be here. We were told this would be done this evening, so this is a negotiated item again with the various entities in the bill. And I'm going to go to Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I can't speak for the advocates here on the intent behind this, but I think when I was drafting the amendment, I was told that this was so that a government entity would have an opportunity to comply with an order before they're subject to a lawsuit to enforce it. So you're giving them 1 month to follow up and provide the data if that's what they're ordered to do.
Can you tell me why it says at least 30 days? Could it be 150 days? Could it be 365 days?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, the minimum you would have to wait before you can go into court to enforce an order of the Office of Administrative Hearings would be 30 days. So you could wait however long you want to after that, so long as you're waiting 30 days at a minimum.
And so I'm trying to put these pieces together
here. The person
here
that would be going into court to enforce the order of the Office of Administrative Hearings would probably be the citizen or the member of the media,
okay,
whoever is not compliant.
Madam Chair and
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Gehring, so after 30 days, they at their own choice could come in any time after 30 days.
Correct.
Any other questions? Any
Chair,
discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Pulaski, I'm just sorry. I'm just not getting quite what this bill does. Would you just say it one more time?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there have been a series of complaints around the state about accessing information, particularly from local units of government, either school board, cities, county. And the only recourse was to go to district court. And to go to district court meant that you're clogging the court system with something that would be to the courts, particularly now, of a very low priority, and it would be expensive. This bill allows another way to get that information, to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It would be much cheaper. There are timelines in the bill that would allow this to facilitate getting that information from those local units of government. It would in essence say that you would get the information in a timely manner, and if you chose then, if they didn't give it to you, you could go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and there'd be a set series of guidelines and timelines saying that the entity would have to provide that public information.
And Madam Chair, is there a cost to the office?
There is a cost to the office, and there is in the bill that they have a revolving fund. There is a $50 fee if you were going to the office. The entity that is pursuing this would have a $50 fee charge.
And Madam Chair, Representative Pulaski, that is sufficient enough to cover the cost of these hearings?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, there's no fiscal note to the bill, and we were careful about having no fiscal note, given the situation that the state's in, particularly with the 6% cut to all agencies.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymer.
If there's no fiscal note, how do you know that the amount's going to cover the amount of the services provided?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymer, we were told this by the office that that would cover it.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Holbrook.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gamerlin can go first. I do have a couple questions and then a comment, but I'm certainly willing to wait.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Gamberling. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. The coalition is a group of citizens, attorneys, media folks, librarians. What we have in common is we're interested in issues of government information and tied to that issues of transparency and government accountability. Let me say at the get-go that, you know, the board of the coalition has discussed this bill. We like what Representative Pawlowski is trying to do. However, we have a couple of issues that I think you should address, okay? Actually, three issues. The first is, and I don't have a copy of the engrossment, so I'm a little bit hindered in giving you line and page references. But in the bill, fairly early on, thank you, Representative Holbert, you'll find that on lines 3-9 and 3-10, if a dispute is about requests for educational data, that you cannot use the new remedy. The language exempts requests for educational data from the remedy. Okay? Now, the problem we have with that is in part based on the years I spent doing this stuff when I worked for the state of Minnesota. There are often disputes about access to education data, and those disputes involve parents seeking access to data about their own kids, okay? And I cannot understand why you would not want to let parents have a simpler, cheaper remedy to resolve those kinds of disputes, okay? I just don't think it makes good policy sense to have that exemption. So, now, if I were representing school boards, I would understand that, but I don't represent school boards. I represent an organization that's concerned with government accountability. The second issue is, and actually Richard Neumeister identified this issue, you'll see that the chapter says that you can bring the new remedy for violations that arise out of Chapter 13. 29 years ago, the Department of Administration, at the direction of the legislature, promulgated rules to implement and enforce the Data Practices Act. If you read the current language literally, you wouldn't be able to bring a complaint that arose under the rules. Okay? I think that's just an omission. I don't think that's a conscious policy decision. And I would recommend that you add language that essentially says you can bring a complaint the new route for violations of the chapter and for violations of the rules promulgated thereunder. The third issue is a little bit more difficult. Part of the problem that brings this bill to you is that in the relationship between government and citizens, there's this kind of power relationship in practical terms. And this is the government. And why is it higher? Because it has, particularly when dealing with just plain folks, it has more resources financially, and it definitely has more resources legally, okay? And so part of what's always gone on with data practices disputes, you know, and this is part of my, and what I'm telling you is based on the 30 years I spent doing this and listening to citizens and listening to government attorneys, part of what happens is you get into disputes that involve time delays, tactical delays, all of which are intended to make sure that whatever the dispute is about really does wear down the citizens. Well, there was a time when the media had a lot of wherewithal and was willing to enter into those contests as matters of principle and law. And I think, frankly, part of the reason the bill hits here is they're looking for cheaper ways to do this, and I applaud them for that. But in these discussions, don't lose sight that these are disputes not just between the media, which has some wherewithal, but disputes involving citizens. And so what the bill is, I first saw this bill maybe 6 weeks ago. Sandy Nern, lobbyist for the Newspaper Association, brought it to me. I looked it over, basically said, good kernel of an idea. And then after that, it got these amendments, including the educational data thing. And it was like, you know, I understand the process. You know, I've been here a long time. But there's stuff that's in here that I just kind of, it starts cutting away at what you're trying to accomplish, what Representative Klawski is trying to accomplish. So in portions of the bill that deal with things like time delays, I think you have to think about whether or not those time delays will really cut away at the basic purpose of the bill. When you have things like a presumption that you get attorney's fees, but then give the government the ability to attack that presumption with arguments about the law is unclear and things like that. Again, if I were representing government associations, I could understand why you would want stuff like that in a bill, because it gives you an opportunity to argue stuff to wear people down.
Excuse me, Mr. Gambling, can you please wrap up? We have some questions.
Yeah, I'm almost done. So, three things then. Get rid of the educational data exemption. Look at adding rules to the coverage of disputes you can bring. And at some point, take a look at the possible tactics of delay and timing that are currently in the bill. And as again, I want to emphasize, what Representative Pawlowski is doing is a really good idea. And thank you. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, after the testimony, wanted to get clear that you're saying that you like what he's doing, you just think he should be doing more of it. And so this committee should take that into consideration. You're not saying to stop Representative Pawlowski's provision.
No, Madam Chair, no. Representative Hilstrom, absolutely not.
Representative Pawlowski.
Madam Chair, this started out as a much more expansive bill. There was a section dealing with open meeting law that we took out in government operations because, frankly, we couldn't reach consensus on it. The amendment that made up now what is the bill, I put on in government operations and laid over for 5 days. 5 days so folks would have the opportunity to look at it and then suggest amendments for changes. I think there are two things you can do. You can come and testify before a committee and state your case, or you can work with members to make changes. And I'm all for public testimony, and that's why I laid it over. If this committee wants to make changes, certainly that's up to the will of the committee. This is a process about compromise. And right now, we have a bill that has been compromised. I think it does. It takes some giant steps for public access of information. But in the will of the committee is the will of the committee. But certainly, this bill has not moved forward fast. It has moved forward in a deliberate process, trying to incorporate as many of the ideas as we could. And we're putting off some things that we're still working on, particularly the open meeting law section.
Thank you, Representative Pawlowski. Any further questions? Representative Holbert.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the $50, I think my understanding is that you have to come up with $1,000 or a bond, and then you're responsible for the hourly fee unless you win, and then the entity pays it. Could you speak? It's more than $50.
I believe Representative Hamar's question was the cost to the Office of Administrative Hearings, if I remember his question. Question is to the individuals that would be pursuing it, but I think his question was the actual cost to the administration.
Well, I think the bill's set up so that the Office of Administrative Hearings costs would be recouped, because you'd have to put up the $1,000. They would draw down on that amount, but at a minimum would take $50, and Ms. Nairn comes running in her bright pink blazer.
Excuse me, she might be late. I thought this was coming up tonight.
I think people should know that it is more than, it could be more than $50 than what the liabilities, and I applaud Representative Pawlowski for this, but the exception for the educational data is very concerning to me, and I think that we as policymakers, I mean, all due respect to Representative Pawlowski, I'm not negating or casting aspersions his way for his efforts or where he's at. We've all been there with advocates trying to move a bill, but the reality is the legislature is the public policy makers. And when you consider that the goal here is to provide an easier process for people to make these challenges, get information, et cetera, I just do not understand why it is in the public's good to exclude educational data. It's in the good of some lobbyists, but if we as public policymakers are here making policy for the good of the public, and Mr. Neumeister isn't here, and while some people may not have appreciation for all the work he does come here on behalf of the average citizen over and over and over again. You know, I think that we need to make that decision. Is it really good policy to exclude all the educational data because the lobbyists for the school boards association or whatever, you know, have fought hard for that exclusion? I have not yet heard anybody articulate a reason why, for public policy reasons, you would exclude that information that actually reflects the needs and rights of the average citizen. And maybe somebody here from the School Board Association could come and convince us why it's a good reason to deny this more expedited or easier process.
Is that a question for Representative Pawlowski or Ms. Nairn?
Madam Chair, I think Representative Pawlowski has been really clear about, you know, how this has worked for him. And like I said, I understand that. I've been there as a bill author. But at some point, sometimes we as a decision-making body, you know, maybe we need to say no, that this is important for all types of data, and we won't support this with this exclusion. We are the ones that have the votes on the floor of the body. And, I mean, I feel very strongly that this should not be excluded. And I told Representative Pawlowski I wouldn't make an oral amendment to his bill right now, but I think that I definitely will on the House floor. And we should make a decision as a body. There, in my mind, is no good reason to exclude educational data from this process. And in the meantime, maybe somebody can convince me otherwise.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holberg. And, in fact, I was going to ask if you intended on doing an oral amendment. Any other discussion to this bill? Any further questions? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2899, as amended, be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Oh, yes.
All right. Okay. The committee stands in recess until 6 o'clock in this room, 6 p.m. tonight.
We have to say we reconvened after we recessed, and so therefore, Representative Mahoney moves House File 2938, and this goes to the General Register, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, go ahead and present your bill.
The only piece in the bill that I think is relevant to this committee arises out of something we did last year. We passed some legislation to allow some homes serving people with disabilities to monitor, instead of having 24-hour people on staff there, to do it electronically. We passed into, for protection purposes, we put in a provision that said you got to destroy the tapes within 5 days. What this legislation would do would keep that, except to say unless there's an investigation of a reported incidence of abuse or neglect, you can keep it for longer, which I think everybody's generally on board with that concept. I talked to Representative Holberg. We are going to work to put a little bit more structure around that, so you know, so that's clear about who has access to that record if it's kept longer than 5 days, and when we destroy, you know, at what point do we destroy it? I'm happy to continue to work on those, that structure going forward, and so that's the bill.
I'm sorry.
Representative Holberg.
And Mr. Chair, I think that Representative Thiessen accurately expressed what some of my concerns are, and I'm happy to work with them, and I think it's time to, unless there's other questions, to move the bill out of committee.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. All in favor of Representative Mahoney's motion to move 2938 to the floor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Chair will move House File 3086. Is that correct? And Representative Thiessen, does this go to the floor? I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Thiessen, go ahead and present your bill very shortly.
Okay.
Extremely shortly.
Yes. Mahoney short. Yeah,
well, follow Representative
he did
Mahoney.
15 seconds earlier today.
Yes, that's what we want.
So this is a legislation that gives rights to domestic partners for certain, so basically for access to sharing data, you know, in health-related situations. And that's what the information that would be shared, you know, with a spouse or other family members, domestic partners would be included in the list of people that this information would be shared with.
Okay.
And that's what the legislation does.
Does anybody in the audience have to speak on this? Okay. Anybody on the panel? Okay, then the chair renews his motion to pass House File 3086 and pass it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
No.
Carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hortman is the only one left, I think. Art, you have one?
Can I move this bill?
Oh, yeah, yes. Representative Mahoney moves the House File 3079. Representative Hortman, go ahead and present your bill. Does this go to the General Register?
No, Mr. Chair. It should go to Finance with a recommended referral to Environment, Finance, and Natural Resources because we don't have a fiscal note yet, but I have a feeling we will.
That's what Representative Mahoney just moved. Okay, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3079 is about streamlining the environmental review and environmental permitting process. In Minnesota, we have kind of a perception problem with the concept of environmental review and environmental permitting. I think for the last about 8 years, there's been a lot of discussion about Minnesota not being a competitive place to do business. And I think the chair is familiar with the efforts of the Small Business Caucus this summer to kind of get at the issue of, are there competitiveness problems for the state and what can we do to solve them? And what House File 3079 does is it seeks to go at the lowest of the low-hanging fruit in the area of environmental permitting and review to start to dispel the myth that we're not competitive and that these things are very uncertain and costly and always duplicative and always take forever and you don't know how the outcome will be. So there's only one section that's relevant to your committee. Would you like me to only talk about that section?
Yes.
Preferably yes.
Okay.
Representative Hortman, we started at 8:30 this morning, so
I know, I'm so glad I wasn't on the committee when I found that out.
What section is that?
I believe it's section 5. Section 5 of the bill, what it does is it takes the review of a decision related to the environmental assessment worksheet, the need for an environmental impact statement, and the adequacy of an environmental impact statement right to the Court of Appeals instead of stopping first at the district court. And this makes the process with regard to environmental review parallel to the process for permits. Right now, if there's a permit decision that's adversely decided in either party's perspective, they go right to the Court of Appeals. This would make that true also in the environmental review area. And we're all familiar with the time delays involved in going to district court and then going to the Court of Appeals. And what happens in these cases is there's a very extensive factual record put together at the local unit of government level. And so the review that's completed by the district court is an appellate-like review. And then the type of review that the Court of Appeals does is an appellate type of review. So it's an efficiency just to skip that first district court step.
Representative Hortman, let me get, just to make sure, you're saying that the district court does not do any fact-finding, they just do an appeal type review?
On this particular type of case.
Okay.
I have with me here Mr. Lightfoot from a practitioner in the Minnesota State Bar Association to testify about this section.
Thank you. Mr. Lightfoot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Thaddeus Lightfoot. I am with the Environmental Law Group, a law firm in Minneapolis. I have practiced environmental law in government and in private practice for over 20 years. Am the former chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association's environmental law section and have been an adjunct professor of environmental law at the William Mitchell College of Law for the last 7 years. And of particular relevance to this committee, I have represented numerous plaintiffs groups, responsible governmental units, and project proposers in environmental review litigation under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. And I testify on behalf of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce in support of House File 3079, and would like to spend just a moment or two discussing Section 5. This section removes or eliminates district court jurisdiction in Minnesota Environmental Policy Act litigation. It will increase the efficiency of environmental review without compromising any of the goals of the statute. The way the statute is written right now, MEPA provides that challenges to environmental review decisions must be filed within 30 days of the decision in the district court of the county where a project would take place. And district court jurisdiction is included in the statute, I believe, because when the Minnesota legislature initially enacted MEPA in 1973, there was no intermediate appellate court. The standard of review under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act is the arbitrary and capricious standard by which a court determines whether an administrative record prepared by a responsible governmental unit, a state agency, a local governmental unit undertaking environmental review supports that governmental unit's decision that the environmental review is adequate. No discovery is allowed, as Representative Horton said. No discovery is allowed in the district court. The district court does not elicit any testimony in a Minnesota Environmental Policy Act action. Rather, the district court decision involves the application of law to information that is generated in the administrative record by a governmental entity. If a party appeals a district court's order in these cases, the Court of Appeals does not defer in any way to the district court's decision. Moreover, the parties in that litigation or in that appeal may not raise new legal arguments in the Court of Appeals. Their legal arguments are confined only to those that are presented in the district court. In other words, in these types of actions, district courts and the Court of Appeals perform exactly the same function. Both courts examine the administrative record to determine whether a responsible governmental unit has complied with the statute as a matter of law. The administrative record is the same in both courts. The standard of judicial review is the same in both courts. The legal arguments are the same in both courts. So currently, by providing two bites at the legal apple, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act delays the ultimate determination of whether a responsible governmental unit has complied with the law, and it increases the cost of all the parties involved, the plaintiffs who challenge these actions, the governmental units who are involved in environmental review, and those parties that propose projects. In essence, all of those parties must go through the same legal process twice. In the most recent case that I litigated, in the most recent Minnesota Environmental Policy Act case that I litigated in the Court of Appeals, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources made a determination that an environmental impact statement for a project was adequate under the statute in August of 2007, but the Court of Appeals didn't decide that the DNR was correct until late September of 2009, because we spent over a year litigating those same issues in the district court. So eliminating duplicative district court jurisdiction won't change the outcome of cases under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. If a responsible governmental unit prepares an inadequate administrative record, or if it acts in another way that is arbitrary and capricious in light of that record, the Court of Appeals will hold that the governmental unit has failed to comply with the statute. And in numerous reported and unreported cases, the Court of Appeals has determined that the Minnesota Environmental or the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and a number of counties and local governments failed to comply with the statute. Nothing in this legislation prevents the Court of Appeals from reversing a governmental decision if that decision is based on a record that is inadequate. So in summary, by eliminating district court jurisdiction under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, the legislation in Section 5 in particular benefits all parties to environmental review actions, plaintiffs, governmental units, and project proposers. The Court of Appeals will be able to consider these cases without the long and unnecessary delay of a duplicative district court proceeding, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that any members of the committee might have.
Why don't we first take, is there any opponents to this? I believe there is a person who wants to oppose it. Why don't you come up and Representative Johnson, can we let him first? Okay, go ahead and state your name and
Bobby King. I represent the Land Stewardship Project. We're a farm and rural organization, and our members have been involved in challenging state agency decisions about environmental review. So our perspective, my perspective, is that of an organization whose members have been plaintiffs. I wanted to pass out, we circulated amongst the environmental community a letter expressing, detailing our concerns, and 17 environmental groups have signed on to it, and I just wanted to pass it out, and it contains most of the points that I wanted to make. One group just added its name before I printed out Clean Water Action, and many of these groups are grassroots groups that whose members have been involved in some of these cases, and you'll recognize others. I won't go deeply into detail about why we feel the 150-day goal is bad policy, because just the timeline that environmental review takes, in many situations that goal is not achievable. We already in Minnesota have the 60-day rule, where permits are issued within 60 days. It's when environmental review happens that the 60-day clock is stopped. So the environmental assessment worksheet, the preparation of that is going to take, according to the EQB, 42 to 120 days. And if that leads to a longer environmental impact statement, it'd be impossible to meet that 150-day goal. Our concern is that the agencies in a rush to try to meet a goal that's not realizable will make bad decisions and shortchange the public. But to the issue of the district court, there's a few things. Our members are rural, and they'd like to have their day in court in their own community. Also, there's often a large group, and they want to see the court in action. And even district courts have proved too small. We had a case in Maurer County where they had to set up a television in another room. That didn't work, and people had to look through the little slit. So the appellate court would really jeopardize people being able to be a part of the process. The other issue is that in all the situations we've been involved in, there's an accompanying zoning permit or building permit that is issued along the same set of facts often, and that's part of the legal challenge, is the permit. That goes to district court. So under this scenario, citizens would have to pursue the environmental review part in appellate court, and the permit issue around the land use in district court. So that's two filing fees, that's paying an attorney to be in two different places. So those are the type of access situations that we're concerned about and feel like this is bad policy.
Thank you, Mr.
And the last thing is an attorney who's represented our members and many others around the state, Karna Peters, had emailed a letter to folks, and I don't know if everyone got it, but I've got a copy for those that didn't, and expressing her concerns about that provision.
Thank you, Mr. King. Representative Johnson, you had a question, and then I have one, and I don't know if there's any.
Well, a comment and then a question. You know, I'm a strong believer in meaningful citizen participation in the environmental review process. Mm-hmm. But I have some concerns about this bill, clearly. And to the lawyer testifier, I forgot your name.
Lightfoot.
Question for you. I was looking at this letter from Attorney Peters and She seems to clearly suggest that citizen input's going to be curtailed by this change from district court to court of appeals and list things, expensive filing, access, less flexibility, difficulty for rural folks to make it happen. What's your response to those concerns?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Lightfoot.
I do not believe that citizen input would be curtailed. In the environmental review process, the most important citizen input, and really the only citizen input that a court may consider, is citizen input that occurs during the during the environmental review process while a responsible governmental unit is undertaking the environmental review and determining whether those environmental review documents are complete. That citizen input, comments on those documents, becomes part of the administrative record. Citizens don't have an opportunity for input either in district court or in the Court of Appeals in environmental review actions. The facts are set by the responsible governmental unit in the administrative record, not in the district court or in the Court of Appeals.
Representative Johnson, did you want to follow? I have a question on a little different. I know that land use planning decisions are appealed to from the Board of Zoning Appeals, go to the district court. So what about the issue of if you have a case that's part environmental review and you're complaining about that, and you're complaining about the land use planning together at the city, and then I don't know on an environmental review from the city council, is there something like the Board of Zoning Appeals that all cities have to have for environmental reviews, or do they go right from the city council to the appeal to the court system? And if you go to both, it seems that there is an argument that maybe they should be looked at by the same court.
Mr. Chairman, first with respect to the City Council, some City Councils have environmental protection committees that consider these matters before they go to the City Council, but it is ultimately the City Council that makes the determination as to whether or not a document for which the City Council is preparing environmental review or a project for which the City Council is preparing environmental review, it is ultimately the City Council's decision, the City Council's final decision.
Then let me maybe cut it short then. So if it's the City Council's final decision, it has to be done in 30 days. That's shorter than the period to go to the Board of Zoning Appeals on a land use planning, as I recall. So they would have to anyhow go to, or at least file in the court beforehand. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the 30-day limit is jurisdictional and is in the statute now. The purpose of environmental review is information gathering. It's to provide not to make a decision. It is to provide information by which not only a city council but other entities that have approval authority over projects may decide to substantively approve the project. So in the circumstances where you have a permit, the permit decision doesn't occur until, and in fact cannot occur until environmental review is complete. And moreover, the question of a permit itself, with respect to most environmental permits that are issued by the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, etc., district courts do not have jurisdiction over those permits. Those are final agency actions, and challenges to those permits must be filed in the Court of Appeals.
Okay, thank you for explaining
could I add
the difference. Mr. King.
Thank you. Usually the land use permits, conditional use permits, in the cases of counties that I'm familiar with, they track right along with the environmental review and are often issued very shortly afterwards or sometimes at the same meeting. So the decision about whether or not to issue the conditional use permit is often based on the findings of fact of the environmental review. So if you feel like that was fundamentally wrong, you're going to challenge both. And under this provision, one would be challenged in district court, and one would be challenged at the appellate court level. And again, citizens, particularly in rural areas, are going to be at a disadvantage. They've got to travel to the Twin Cities for the appellate court. They've got two filing fees, and so on. That's been our experience with how these cases have moved. And does that make sense?
Well, I guess, Mr. Lightfoot, it sounds to me like there's a little argument between the two of you exactly what happens in each case.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. We're talking about a different type of permit. Certain permits that are issued by state agencies are only eligible to be challenged in the Court of Appeals. Conditional use permits are slightly different. But the point is that a conditional use permit, a local government cannot make a determination to issue a conditional use permit until environmental review is complete.
Okay. And that includes appellate level.
Well, and that's the challenge. But so no, Mr. Chairman, it would not. It would include they could issue the permit, but there's a possibility that the environmental review might be reversed. The permit decision is different from the information gathering purpose of environmental review and the ultimate determination that an environmental assessment worksheet or an environmental impact statement satisfies the informational purposes of the statute. And then it's that information that local governmental entities use to make a substantive decision as to whether or not to issue a conditional use permit, or the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency would use to make a substantive decision to issue an environmental permit.
Is there any... Representative Paymar, did you have a question?
I don't have a question, but I'd like to make a motion that when the discussion is, I apologize for being late. I was wrapped up with my budget.
Well, Representative Paymar, I don't see anybody else's hand up, so
okay.
If you wanted to make a motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I apologize for being late, and I missed all of the discussion and the debate, but I'd like to move that we delete Section 5 of the bill.
Representative Horneman, I assume you didn't look excited about that motion.
I understand. I definitely understand Representative Paymar's reasons for making it, and I understand the Land Stewardship Project's arguments in favor of striking Section 5, but I think the discussion that we've had tells you why I think Section 5 should be in there. I think it makes the system more efficient. I do not think it places the environment at any greater risk. I do not think that it diminishes a citizen's ability to be engaged in this process, and so I oppose the amendment.
Okay, is there any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, Representative Paymar renews his motion to delete Section 5 of the bill. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? No.
No.
Doesn't carry. It fails. Is there any further discussion of House File 3079? Was it me that moved?
I made the motion.
Oh, Mahoney. Then Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass House File 3079 and refer it to the general. To finance. All in favor, say aye.
Sorry, I'm
being
distracted by the phone. Sorry.
I think that means he has to bring cookies to the last meeting.
Oh, yeah. Should we try this vote again?
Yeah, try it again. Because I have this silly thing on because I was up in the room for a minute.
Is nobody in favor of them? We will try again. Representative Mahoney renews his motion to pass 3079 and refer it to finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Did better that time. Carries, you pass. We're adjourned.